This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is June 26, 1997. I'm in my office in Goodnight Hall with Archibald Haller. We're continuing our interview. Dr. Haller came in with a few things he wanted to tie up from last time. And you said that you were discussing flaws in stratification literature.
Yes. These were very, in my judgment, very serious flaws, and flaws that were and are really quite difficult to correct. The first one of these I began to notice in 1954 or thereabouts in talking to Brazilian graduate students. I think I might have mentioned earlier that when that Professor Kolb had a couple of Brazilian graduate
yes,
students, and that he asked me to advise one of them on his thesis, and in order to advise him, I had to listen to him. Then listening to him, I came to the conclusion that there were very rapid changes in the structure of stratification going on in Brazil that he was naively reporting. It didn't have anything to do directly with his thesis, but I was imposing these categories on what he said, because he doesn't know to this day, well, what he told me, but then we were already beginning research in the United States on what came to be called status allocation or status attainment processes, in which you try to anticipate on information from people when they're very young in high school or before. What the socioeconomic levels will be that they will have later on in life, 15, 20, 30, 40 years later. Mm-hmm. I came to the conclusion in listening to this fellow that if the stratification structures of Brazil were changing with all that great speed, they probably were in the United States too, and yet nobody knew anything about how to think systematically about changes in the structure of stratification. So that was the first one, and I'll go on a little bit with that. I couldn't do anything about it at the time. I had turned down a position that Kolb had tried to arrange, or had arranged really, in Rio de Janeiro to continue work on research that I was interested in, and he was too. But I turned it down because Bill Sewell got a grant to work on what we later came to call status attainment or status allocation processes, and that was where I felt the heart of my own work mm-hmm. was, and it was at that mm-hmm. time, it remains important to me. Now, for a couple of years, I worked with Bill on that, and then went over to Michigan State as a professor. When time came to have a sabbatical from Michigan State, I had two options that I had in mind, and I think I mentioned both of these the last time, but I'll repeat them. One of them was to go down to the University of Michigan and work with a brilliant a little bit of everything, but I wanted to learn. My one idea was to learn something about mathematical sociology, which is still in bad shape today, mm-hmm. but was in worse shape at that time, and that would have directed my career in one way, or the other was to go to Brazil and to work on social stratification mm-hmm. and see what if I could figure out why it was or how it is that stratification structures vary, and so that ultimately we could work their variations into the kinds of thought systems, equations best to predict or explain the status allocation levels of people over time in this changing structure in which they were attaining their positions. Well, that was the first one, and that took a lot of work, and it still it's not very well understood today. I don't know why, because it's easy to think about. But it would be for anybody if they pay any attention to it. But the second one came about, and in the 1960s, if you look at the status between 1954 and 1965-66, a lot happened in the research that by the end of that period was coming to be called status attainment or status allocation processes. And it focused almost exclusively on the occupational prestige levels of people as they came to occupy their positions and as the years went by, and also their intervening education. And I looked hard at that material. It was very good empirically. It was, and remains today, very good work. But it was interesting that it hardly touched at all on what the classical writers on stratification considered to be the most important variables, and instead of occupational status, which is important enough, but and education, they were more concerned with either power variations or economic status variations, money, in other words, and the status allocation line was empirically was just excellent, and the Europeans were not just sloppy empirically; they were non-existent, and yet their speculations were pretty good, and I thought, that's another flaw in our research. We really ought to find ways to incorporate economic status and power differentials. Later on, as time passed, a number of people began to work and pay attention to a little bit to economics and some aspects of it, and began to work money into their thinking. Power differentials, nobody works on them.
Why not?
I don't know. I really don't know why not.
Are they that hard to measure?
Well, they're very hard to measure, and they if you go back 20 or 30 years, a number of political scientists tried to get close to that, and they all failed. And I think the sociologists who were looking at it would say to themselves, "Well, these people know what they're doing, and they're not succeeding. Why should we spend our time on it?" But there are ways to do it. I'm not sure whether it'd be comparable across countries. I rather doubt it. But within countries, there are ways of doing of measuring individual power differentials in the political arena. And we worked out some for a fairly simple political system in Brazil, and that appeared in one article and also in Elcio Saraiva's PhD thesis. Absolutely nobody paid any attention to it. And we worked out some other ways here in Wisconsin the Brazilian system is very individualistic, and you have the structure, and you have people who are able to recall instances where they tried to get somebody at a given hierarchical level of the system to do something, and they really got it done. And you do it individually. Here, nobody does that, or hardly anyone does that individually. It's done by large groups like the Farmers Union or Farm Bureau or political parties and so forth. And people, in other words, people come together on common interests to try to effect changes in whatever legislation they're interested in, which means that they're able to exert legitimate political influence through group processes that they participate in. So anyway, it can be done. It's kind of tricky.
But it sounds kind of important, too.
Well, I would think so.
I mean, I've read enough Shakespeare to know the uses of power.
Of course.
It seems like almost all the things would lead to that, ultimately, even the money and everything.
Oh, they do. And anybody who's been around in a great university for a while can see instances where individual professors have had an impact on some aspect of the political process by working through people who are in positions that are hierarchically organized. And the most recent one that comes to mind is that it's not just individual, it's individual and group. Just in the last few days, a bill for international activities on the part of the U.S. government went through the Senate, and our senator over here in Middleton was on the committee that did it. The Fulbright grants and allocations were in that bill. One of the key figures in the Fulbright program got in touch by email with a bunch of people mm-hmm. who had Fulbrights and asked them to write a letter thanking or urging that the senator do something to protect that valuable program, valuable to the United States. Mm-hmm. And he did. So you can see that this is one of the ways democracy mm-hmm. works. Mm-hmm. I think probably any political system works to some extent that way, whether it involves large numbers of people or just particular personal influence. Well, that is a variable, mm-hmm. but at any rate, these people don't work on it, and that's another major flaw. Now, there are a couple of others that that the literature has a couple of major hypotheses that go way back to the end of the 60s and early 70s to the effect that the higher the level of the development of a nation, national development, the less stratified a society is. Well, the fact is nobody's ever really tested that very well. One of the ideas would be the higher the level of development, the more social mobility there would be, not only because the whole structures are rising, which they do because you slough off occupations that machines can do and you add occupations that machines can't do, then the systems tend to rise occupationally. But besides that, there should be more up and down mobility, circulation mobility around that. And there's been a fair amount of international comparative research, but it's all among developed countries. Mm-hmm. And so that's another flaw. And that's a third, and it's finally becoming evident. And there may be a fourth now, and that is that it involves the question of what constitutes national development anyway. And if national development is more than one thing, then how do the more than one things called national development bear on stratification? And I'm trying to think about that right now. But at any rate, the major hypothesis of the higher the level of development of a society, the less stratified it is essentially untested on international data in any sensible way. Some of us, a fellow named Grusky, who was a graduate student here and is now out of Stanford, may be coming back here. I think he is. Tested that sort of hypothesis on purely Japanese data using regional development levels, that is, studying people in regions of different levels of development and the forms of stratification, and we've done some of the same kind of strategy on Brazil. In fact, he picked it up in a course of mine, and he's a brilliant fellow. So it was his first semester here in Madison as a 20-year-old graduate student, and he picked up the idea, and he and a colleague got some data from the leading Japanese sociologist, and he tested the hypothesis a couple of years later while he was still a graduate student. He published a major article on it. Anyway, Grusky's a powerful brain and a very fine fellow. It's been done on national data a little bit. We've done some of that on Brazilian data, and he's done some of it on Japan. Apart from that, it really hasn't been done. And anyway, those are within nations and they're not between nations, mm-hmm. which is where it really should be. I guess I should mention, too, as long as we're on these flaws, we really wanted to use Brazilian data to test the development and stratification hypothesis for a number of reasons. For one thing, a lot of the developing countries don't have such data anyway. And another one is when you do have what appear to be fairly useful data, they may not be comparable from country to country. Well, the Brazilian data are comparable, and they're national. And Brazil's been gathering very good social and economic data on itself since the late 60s. And we had access to data that was specifically on stratification, which were taken across the whole nation, I think 270,000 individual cases, probability sample, and taken in 1973. We used that. But we needed a way to measure development, and that brings up another sub-problem. And that sub-problem was, how do you know that the development regions that Brazilian government recognizes officially are the way regional development is really distributed throughout the country? There's a long line of research on that in Brazil, and in fact the official one was done by back in the 40s by a graduate student in geography who I know because his son, who is an ambassador in Brazil, and told me.
A graduate student here?
No. The father who did that original research on which the legal regionalization of Brazil is based was a graduate student here when he did it, yes. Hmm. But I got it from the son, who must be 60 years old now. Anyway, we decided to do that, and we did. And I think I might have mentioned some of this. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't, because it had such an impact. We found that if you take very small units, and the Brazilian government had at that time, back in the late 70s when we did this work, it had a good aggregated social and economic data on 360 aerial units that they called micro-regions, and they covered the whole country. And what I did was to use those micro-regions as a unit of analysis and then go back to the best literature on national development and the best literature on the socioeconomic levels of families and pick the variables that were considered as the ones really to be looked at by the people that had been studying these issues for 50 or 75 years. And I picked out about a dozen or so variables and got them. The Brazilian government gave me the data for each one of those variables for 1970 data aggregated for each one of the micro-regions and re-regionalized Brazil, and I found out that there are a couple of things that really knowledgeable Brazilians have seen anyway, but nobody paid any attention to. And these have to do with what the regional boundaries are, what constitutes a socioeconomic development region of the country. What had been done previously was to use the state lines as the units of a major region. And this makes sense politically in Brazil because states have power and they're part of the political game in the country. But we weren't interested in the political game. We were interested in finding what the natural boundaries are, quite apart from whether they happen to overlap or cut into state boundaries. So we've completely ignored state boundaries.
You mean like rivers and... you mean natural in that sense, or
no? I mean natural in the sense that you get breaks in the scores of these micro-regions. I guess maybe natural is not the best word for that. Natural region reasons on social data.
Natural. Okay, there you go. Gotcha. I start going off when you said
sure.
that.
Sure. Well, one of the things the most surprising thing in the literature was this area of extreme poverty, a low level of development, that is, 1,600 kilometers from north to south and 1,000 kilometers wide, that incorporated all of two states, a third of another state, chunks of others, and at any rate, it was a vast area, and it was really multiple state area. And the second was that, second and third put together, was that the official regionalization separate between what they call the center-south and the south, but if you look at them in terms of development levels of the populations, they're the same area. They're not two different areas. But we're circling around the north end of this developed area is a developing periphery where suddenly the scores go down, but they don't go down nearly as far as they do for this great northern region, either for this one that we identified, for the part of it to the east that's called Brazilian Northeast, or for the Amazon region, all of which are low. But so that you have the developed south, a developing periphery around parts of the south, just an arc around it, and then you have these other regions where you have a northeast that's in terms of micro-regional levels of the populations is really low but variable. And you have this one that's low and not variable. And then you have the Amazon region where very few people live. Mm-hmm. It's pretty low where they do live, but not abysmally low. Mm-hmm. And so, and all this was brand new in the literature. And I know it had an impact, and I think it had an even bigger one than I know about, for certain. The one I know about is that the Brazilian Agricultural Research Service decided that given the fact that this area had been identified, they needed to have a research institute for agriculture in the area, so they mounted one there. And the people who did it had told me it was specifically because of this research. So that one I know about. The other one is very interesting and even more, much more interesting, and that is in 1988, the Brazilian government passed a new constitution. And in the constitution, they allowed for they made some territories into states, but apart from those territories, they allowed certain states to divide in two if they wanted to, if their populations wanted to. And guess what? All of the ones that were given the authority to divide in two cut into that area of extreme poverty. Now, I don't know whether it's because the people that were working on the Constitution were looking at the same sorts of things we were, or whether they knew about the literature or what.
Interesting.
But
any way you can check up on that?
Well, I suppose it could be done, but it'd be a lot of work, yeah. And I never.
That's very interesting.
It's conceivable. Well, it might turn out to be easy, but it might be the Pastore, since Pastore had something to do with drafting a constitution.
Yeah. And since he knew a lot of the shit.
And he would have known that. He might have told somebody else. Or the son, this is more interesting, the son of the fellow who did the official regionalization knew about it too, because this overlaps with some of another thing that you want to talk about later, because when I was in Paris for those 3 months with UNESCO in 1989, I happened to be walking down the street looking for a place to have supper. And it was close to the UNESCO area, and I ran into an old friend who now is the Minister of Science and Technology, who at that time was the chair of UNESCO's executive board of 50-some-odd ambassadors. He was sitting there with this fellow. My earlier friend was José Israel Vargas, who's a physicist. He was sitting there with an ambassador from Sweden and this Macedo Suárez, who was the son of the geographer who had done his work here. And we sat down, and Vargas knew about the research, so he started pumping me about it. But he was really trying to tell Macedo Suarez about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I found out about this history of regionalization, that aspect of it in Brazil. But it could be that either Vargas or Pastore or Macedo Suarez or, I don't know, any one of several other people could have put somebody onto that literature or could have just passed a word or just said, take a serious look yourself at that area and you'll see it, mm-hmm. that it's there. Because when people really who know Brazil, there are not many who know Brazil as a whole, including Brazilians, because they normally know their local area, mm-hmm. and that's about it. They know what they're taught in school, but what they're taught in school is important, but it's not very deep. And so they could have found out in other ways too. It could have been in one of the ways we just suggested. But at any rate, that has been a... I'm pretty sure it had other effects too, like investment in that peripheral region. I know Vargas, when he first found out about it, at the time he was... Vargas first found out about this regionalization back when it was initially published, was around 1982, 1983. And by 1984 or so, he must have had it all down pat. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was responsible for a lot of work on initiating regional development. And since then, I've noticed that the investment of primarily southern entrepreneurs in that developing, in that thing we call the developing periphery, of the South has really blown into large proportions, and now areas that were formerly just brush are now blooming agricultural areas and so forth.
Hmm.
So there may have been other effects of it too. But anyway, we did it not because we were trying to do anything for Brazil. We did it because we wanted to have a good measure of the development levels of the regions people lived in so that we could at least get one test of this hypothesis that the development level of a society affects the stratification structure and in the following way, according to theory, and that is that higher the level of development, the lower the degree of stratification. By the way, it is, at least in Brazilian data, it isn't so.
It isn't?
No, not at all. It's a much more complicated picture than that. And if anything, Sao Paulo, the south of Brazil, is the most highly stratified part of the country. But it doesn't look that way to people because it's the most highly developed area. Men wear the same kind of suits and whatnot everywhere, regardless of how well-to-do they are, and are they very pretty much the same ways? And there are so many well-to-do people that they're not particularly noticeable anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the northeast of Brazil, which people always claim is the most stratified part of Brazil, in some respects it is, but you look at the data on it and it says, no, what you've got there is not such a highly stratified society. It's one of an equality of the outs. Mm. But there you have to ask, well, why does everybody think that the Northeast is so stratified? Well, the reason they think it is because the people who are really high status there are so obvious. I believe that's why it is. There are so few that they stand out. They dress differently, their accents are differently, they're educated and nobody else is. They have contacts internationally. And the great bulk of the population, 85-90% of the population, are just very, very poor and very low-level occupations and so forth. So I think that the perception of greater stratification in the Northeast is a consequence of the visibility of those who are high, whereas they're just not so visible in the more stratified South.
Interesting. So this is another example for observation you can use observation to make these determinations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, I wouldn't even, I'd say guesstimates.
Guesstimates, okay.
That's our interpretations. Yeah. That's the way I think it is, but I...
Makes sense to me.
I know that the data show an equality of the outs in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that conflicts with what everybody who knows anything about Brazil, except has never looked at any numbers, says is the case. So at any rate, we worked. The third flaw was really the hypothesis that development induces destratification was untested, and we've tried to test it in limited ways, but I would say it's still not really tested well, and won't be until it's possible to have data on of the proper type and quality on a great many very poor countries. Now, the fourth that's coming up now is the question of what, after all, constitutes national development. And I'm really writing on that right now because, with my Indian colleague, who really was the one who...
You're working with your Indian colleague?
Yeah, Professor Sharda is a professor at the University of Utah, but he's one of the lead figures in that stratification group that's international.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I've worked on development issues in Brazil, when he came here over the last year or much of it, the party wasn't in India, we have been working together on the measurement of national development. And to make a longer story short, what we found is first that there are two dimensions of national development, not one. One of the two dimensions is the one everybody talks and thinks about, and that is socioeconomic levels of the population are high, the infant mortality rates are low, life expectancy at birth is long, and so on. The other one, something else first. A lot of policy planners and those who vote budgets and so forth for development purposes really have that dimension in mind, and they think that the countries with high levels of it are the models for everybody else to follow. There is, however, a critical sociology line led by a fellow named Wallerstein that apparently agrees with the existence of this same dimension, although they categorize it some in rough classes, core countries, peripheral countries of two, three types, and instead of having scores or numbers for the development levels, but it's the same dimension, just classified differently. They don't look at this, at the high scoring nations as the good guys, the way most people who pay attention to such things do. They seem to look at the high scorers as predatory nations. Now, when we factor analyze the best measures of that have been proposed for development by whatever organization, by researchers, academic researchers, by the Wallerstein types, by the United Nations, the World Bank, and so forth, when we found the best variables from those and factor analyzed them, we found two dimensions, not one. And the first and most powerful one is the one that's the standard one. But the second one is loaded mostly with the size of the population. And then next are the Wallerstein categories, and that's about all.
Hmm.
So that it looks as though the Wallerstein types, these critical sociologists, haven't really been looking at the same variable that they thought they were all along. They've been looking at another one, but they never get any data on anything. So my guess is that they really, with all due respect to their supposed historical competency, my guess is that they don't know what they're talking about.
Interesting.
So that's what we're working on now, and I'm trying to work out what the next generation's hypotheses ought to be for stratification research in light of the complexity of the number of variables that you have to deal with to understand destratification as a, just as what it is in itself, and its relationship to these development variables.
So this is still a work in progress?
Oh yeah, I'm writing it at home right now.
Yeah.
Well, the article that identifies the two dimensions is on the way out. It's scheduled to be published any time now. But the linkage of that with the stratification literature is what I'm working on now to give in a paper in Quebec and in August. And then we'll see what happens to it after that. If I get pummeled.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this something that you're going to get up there and all of a sudden you're going to start dodging bricks? Probably, but
I know who's going to throw them pretty much and why they're going to throw them.
Well, basically, what is their, the people who you would expect to react negatively, what will their argument be in a nutshell?
Well, it's going to, in a nutshell, it's going to be, well, all those variables that you talk about aren't very important anyway. And what's my answer is, how do you know? Because you never looked at them.
Yeah.
And I think that's basically going to be it. At least as far as the stratification variables, in this hypothesis that development destratifies, there are two main statements of it, and they're really not much agreement with each other. But they're not terribly inconsistent. They just are sort of talking past each other. One of them is by a very bright fellow historically named Gerhard Lenski, who's at University of North Carolina. And Lenski is concerned with the changes in what he calls inequality, read stratification, going all the way back to prehistory and up to the present. And the other, and his concern is with what he calls inequality, but we know now that inequality, there are several inequalities, and you need to think about each one of them, and they don't vary together necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so that you, in that sense, he's wrong. The other one is a fellow named Don Triman, who used to be here, and he's a very bright fellow, and his main interests are occupational status mobility comparisons around the world. He wrote a very influential article in 1970 on industrialization and what he called social stratification. So it would be better stated as industrialization differences among countries in relationship to the forms of status allocation. Specifically, how much effect the parental statuses have on the person's status and how much the education of the individual has. The idea being that in less industrialized societies, the level of the parent's status is the controlling factor on the level of the individual status many years later on. Whereas in the developed societies, the industrialized ones, it's the education that it counts, and status origins don't count as much. Well, so you have these are the two main positions in the literature, and essentially neither one of them has been tested right. Mm-hmm. Lenski never tried to test hypotheses, at least of this sort. And he just worked out in the literature, and he's a sophisticated sociological historian. And Triman is a very good empirical sociologist and one of the leading stratification people in the world. When he wrote the article, he wrote it as a set of assertions, not as conclusions. And he called them assertions. He was right. But the little testing has been done doesn't give very much support for the notion. And in any case, we know now that we shouldn't be just talking about status allocations and industrialization. We should be talking about destratification much more generally, with a whole series of variables, and development levels. Now we know that we have to take into account two kinds of development, not one.
Yeah.
And then that's where we are.
Well, those are the questions that you have to be able to answer before you can make those movements forward.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, that's the way I see it.
Good luck on your July comp.
It's August.
August. Good luck on your August.
Well, Truman and I have argued a lot over the years anyway. And,
oh, and nothing like a good argument.
And so maybe once. Once I published an article, kind of was really new to the literature at the time, and in effect, it said that stratification structures are not necessarily, occupational hierarchies are not necessarily identical around from country to country, and I showed data on that, and Triman, he blistered it, because he had already done some stuff that assumed that they were comparable. Then he wrote a book on occupational hierarchies and published in 1977, and I was sent a copy of it to review by one of the journals. And right after I got it, I got a copy from him, and it was across it. He said, "See, everything is alike everywhere," and with his name signed on it. And I sat on that for a year because I couldn't think of anything that I hadn't already said before. In a 1965 publication, I couldn't think of anything new. So I finally took his data and I reanalyzed it and I showed that, he overestimated the similarity and could show why. But it took me a year to think mm-hmm. through how to go about doing it. But so anyway, he and I have been, we've had our arguments back and forth, but he's really a very able guy. He's now at UCLA mm-hmm. and UCLA is really coming up in the world.
Is it?
Oh yeah.
Even with the downfall or of a lot of the California schools?
Yeah, well they've been hit pretty hard both politically and economically ever since Reagan went in.
Proposition 213 or whatever.
The universities, the quality University of California, Berkeley, it dipped for a while, it's going back up again. UCLA is rising. I can't speak for the university as a whole, but I, in my judgment, the sociology program there is really underestimated. The quality of the faculty is just excellent. The good ones. Now they may have a string of those who are second level too, but they have a number of really first-rate sociologists in that department, and the department should be rated more highly than it has been. But those things take years to work out. I keep hoping that ours stays high because it is, and not because people don't really realize what's happened. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to say on flaws.
Well, we were also talking before the interview about another issue you wanted to address, and that's the you're continuing to work in Brazil, and you wanted to talk about your former graduate students mm-hmm. and how they have risen within within the mm-hmm. profession and within the society itself.
Yes, and there are several of them. I just picked out a few individuals, and one of them is a Paraguayan who did his master's degree here, and then he did his PhD with me over at Michigan State. But actually, he came back to Madison in summer of '64 when I was a visiting professor here to work on his PhD thesis. Juan became the leading, Latin America's leading agricultural communication specialist. And he was very influential. He was with the Inter-American Institute of Agricultural Sciences.
You didn't say his last name, Juan?
Juan Diaz, D-I-A-Z.
Okay.
Also, he has a longer last name that the Brazilians use a lot, Bordenave. Borden, A-V-E. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So it comes out of Juan Diaz Bordenave often. When the Brazilian Federal Agricultural Research Service was formed, he was one of the key figures in planning it. Pastore was another one. And I mentioned earlier several times João Gonçalves de Souza, who was But Juan João Gonçalves himself wasn't directly, his brother-in-law was. And then there was another person who did his master's with the Department of Rural Sociology here and never did a PhD, very bright fellow named Renato Simplicio Lopes. And Renato was one of those figures who, in other words, there were two rural sociology PhDs, another who was an agricultural journalism type, communication PhD from Michigan State, but was my student who did his PhD research on Brazil, and who did most of his, had most of his career working out of Brazil, and plus another person with more tangential but real relationships to the Department of Rural Sociology, who really designed the Federal Agricultural Research Service for Brazil, which went into place by legislation about 1972, 1973. Juan is one fairly, the most influential of all is José Pastore. I had mentioned, well, let me talk simultaneously about Pastore, Saraiva, and an American named David Hansen, who up until the last few months was the Dean of Agricultural, International Agriculture at Ohio State University. Those three were in Brazil all at the same time, and all of them struggling to get research done. The one American, the one Paraguayan who lived in Brazil, married to a Brazilian, and Pastore, who was really altogether Brazilian. Oh, then Saraiva, who was also a Brazilian. They were all back in Brazil. They were all struggling to use the knowledge that they had gained and were finding great difficulty in doing it. It was that, at that point that I wrote a letter, a long letter, that should, I probably have it in my record someplace, probably should save it. To one of the vice presidents of the Ford Foundation, and just pointed out that these people had very unique skills, that if they continued the way they were going, in 5 years they would have lost the skill that they had, and they would of course fail to keep up with what the changes in the field, and wasn't it possible for somebody to find some way to break them out of this cycle of extreme constriction on possibilities of doing research. So the Ford Foundation then made a grant to their office in Rio de Janeiro for sociological research. And they made it on a competitive basis, and Saraiva and Pastore and Hansen, all three won the awards, and each one of them made very good use of it. That launched the careers of Pastore and Saraiva. I think it didn't hurt Hansen's career at all, but I think his channels were a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But then Pastore became a professor in the, not in sociology, because the sociologists in Brazil don't like numbers, but in economics. In the Institute of Economic Research at the University of São Paulo. And then from there he rose to be full professor, and he did a lot of research, and we did a lot of work together. Same thing happened to Saraiva. These were such bright people as graduate students. They're just a joy to work with or around. Pastore was actually Wilkening's advisee, but we worked together a lot. The others were my advisees. The Saraiva went back to Brazil, and for a while he was an associate professor of sociology at what was then Brazil's second university, University of Brasilia. While he was there, Pastore and Saraiva and I decided to have a conspiracy. We looked at Alejandro Portas, whose name has come up before.
A few times, yes.
And we were convinced that Alex would be one of the leading political sociologists of Latin America and working on Latin America in the years to come, and we felt he didn't know much about Brazil, so we went into a conspiracy to get him into Brazil. And so he went to teach at where Saraiva was, and he did that for 6 months on a Fulbright, and the Ford Foundation picked him up, and he was a Ford Foundation consultant in Rio for another 8 months, I guess, something like that. And since he's absolutely indefatigable, he did research while he was there, and he kept his eyes open, and he learned a lot. So these people play back on each other, too. But at any rate, Saraiva, to make a slightly longer story shorter, was asked to build a federal university. And so he went up to the northeast in this part that we had come to identify as the poorest area, which is sort of off from the northeast a little bit. And he did just that. He built a federal university. He was president of it for a while. And he's had a brilliant career. Right now, he's the CEO of Brazil's largest scholarly funding agency. Pastore is no longer, he's technically retired from the university, and he does a lot of work. He's advising the president of Brazil, on who himself is a sociologist, or was, and very famous, by the way, as a sociologist. And he's doing a lot of other work, and we may still be collaborating. We haven't written anything together for about a year and a half, but that doesn't mean we won't. Mm-hmm. We may or may not. Another one is Tarcísio Quirino. It's very interesting. None of these people were accepted by the sociology people. Pastore's position was in economics. He's better known as an economist in Brazil than as a sociologist, but his training is all sociology.
Well, now you said the sociologists don't do numbers down there. Is it just a theoretical? What do they do?
Well, they, I could exaggerate a little bit.
Go ahead.
The tendency is for them to repeat things that are said in France. And they're still hung up on Marxism and where a lot of American Marxists have finally discovered that there are numbers and that they count, and that you could really look at realities with numbers correctly gathered. Those people have not. And none of these people that I'm mentioning worked out well and sociology programs. Saraiva was there for a while. There were three very able sociologists working together there for a while. Saraiva, Portis, and another one who's now at the University of Florida, and who is Berkeley trained. Those three were teaching the strongest courses in the department. And a beautiful woman with a fast tongue who was married to official of the East German government and who herself was teaching there, organized a student movement against, particularly against Portis, by the way, but against all three left. Portis, as I said, went down to Ford Foundation. Saraiva became president for a while of a federal university that he built, and then he went on to a number of other key things. He was head of the National Educational Research Institute for a while, and a number of other such things. But at any rate, no longer teaching sociology. Quirino, Tarcísio Quirino, is another very bright, serious scholar, and he went back to the Federal University of Pernambuco in the northeast of Brazil, in the city of Recife, which is, it's got a department of about 70 professors of sociology. And he finished his PhD here in 1974, went back there, and he lasted about a year, and he got fed up and left, and went to He went to a couple of things, but for many years now, he's been a key figure in EMBRAPA, the National Agricultural Research Agency. And that's where he is now. He spent 2 years with us here, just 1995, 1996, or 1994, 1995. And Saraiva has spent a couple of years here as a visiting professor. Another one is Manuel Torino. Torino is now professor and has just built a new department called Department of Socioeconomics at the Faculty of Agrarian Sciences in the Amazon region. And he's himself from the Amazon region, and he's had a number of very important administrative positions before becoming a professor. Among them, he was the executive director of the National Agricultural Research Agency. So all these people, they've really, as I said, they have risen in Brazilian society, and the reason they do it is because they can think things that most people don't think about, but need to be thought about, and they can do it in a way that's dependable. And that's what the empirical rigor is all about. I have to mention one other person who's been very important to me, but is not a sociologist. I mentioned him a little bit ago, and that's José Israel Vargas. Vargas was the director of a planning, a research planning organization when one of these people, Saraiva, asked me if I would consider inviting him to Madison to give a talk or just to talk about things. Mm-hmm. So I did, and we became close friends at that time. As I said, he's a physicist by now. He's a statesman. He still works once in a while at the Physical Research Institute in Rio de Janeiro, but mostly he's a statesman, and right now he's a minister of science and technology. But he's one of these people who is not limited by his field. He's a nuclear physicist, and had a lot to do with nuclear policy. He was the scientific advisor to the French government for the French Atomic Energy Commission, specifically, for a number of years, and he ran a bunch of projects at Grenoble. That was while he was in exile during a part of the authoritarian military government in Brazil. Yeah. Then when he came up here, one of the things that we found out is we have some interests. Well, he understands sociology, which is kind of interesting in itself. And we had some interest in Brazilian literature and some other kinds of things in common that we just happened to get on to. We happened to be driving around the countryside looking at pretty Madison and its surroundings at the time. But we've been exchanging books and whatnot ever since. But so he's been pretty important to me too. And as the years have gone by, all these people have gotten to know each other. So in many respects, it seems to me that you could say that almost everything comes together at the cupolas. Yeah. But the point I was really trying to make, besides the fact I'm very proud of these people, yes. is that they have, one way or another, asked me to come back and do things with them. So that
what kind of things have they asked you to do?
Research, usually, mm-hmm. or give talks and on research and so forth. In 1970, Pastore came back here and he said to me that he was launching a piece of research on on the remuneration of managerial support personnel in São Paulo's factories, which I mentioned
right.
to you. And I said, okay, because that was money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to learn a little bit. I learned something about money and power, and I did, I think. And then other times on social mobility research, one day, this may be important. Once in 1974, when I was there, Pastore and Saraiva and I went over to the National Statistical Agency and to talk about cooperating in research. And to my surprise, I wound up giving a lecture on changes in stratification and its relationship to social unrest, which I've been speculating about. So we were then offered the national data, that data, 1973 national data set that I mentioned, and we did social mobility research on that. Up until a year and a half ago, we were still doing mobility research together, using new data as it came available and so forth. Now, why I say that talk might have been important, I don't know, but the strategy that was used by the military government in backing out of control of the country was precisely what this theory dictates. Now, whether they invented that by themselves or somebody from that agency trotted over and talked to somebody in the presidency, I don't know.
Right.
But it's possible. I just don't know, because it's exactly what we would predict. The point being that there are rapid changes of any sort upset people, because they people can't predict what each other's behaviors are going to be. And that's called anomie, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
and changes in stratification that increase inequality are thought by other lines of thinking to be disruptive. But then if you have a change in stratification that's very fast, and it's a disequalizing or an increase in the degree of stratification, and it's going on very fast, that's a condition under which you ought to expect the combined effects of those two things to operate. And disengagement process that the military government followed was very interesting. They didn't tell anybody what it was. They didn't tell anybody they were doing it. They just did it, and they did it little by little. I happen to be around to hear, to see a good deal of it, and it's fascinating, and maybe I should even write it up. But what it amounted to was this, that censorship had been complete. All labor activity had been repressed, and had been repressed.
You said it had been repressed brutally?
So one day, I was sitting in one of the offices in the University of São Paulo, and I happened to look at the main newspaper of the country at that time, the Estado de São Paulo. And the Estado de São Paulo had been very interesting during the repression, the military repression, because they had not completely bowed to censorship. What they had done was, when parts of a column were censored and cut out, they put poetry in its place.
Mm.
And so you'd read along on a story, and all of a sudden you run into a poem that was written 300 years ago, and then you go back to the story. Well, that day there was no censorship, and these Estado de São Paulo's articles were published straight. Nobody said a thing. Then, a little bit later, there was an opposition party that had really been formed by the military governments for their own reasons. All of a sudden, with the elections coming up, they found themselves with 4 hours of TV time that they were totally unprepared for. It was just there. You can have it. And they'd never had any before. And then, right shortly after that, there was a strike of transportation workers in Rio de Janeiro. At everybody's astonishment, there was no repression. It just took place.
Mm.
And right, that was followed by another strike, a big one and Belo Horizonte are the metal workers. And the metal workers, since they're also the auto workers and the steel workers and so forth all together in one huge union, that was a pretty important strike, and much more important than just stopping people from moving around in the city of Rio. That one went on. That's kind of some curious stories connected with them, and maybe I won't mention. But anyway, the whole series of steps, and when one of these took place, it was fixed, and there was no more censorship. There was time on TV. There was no more repression of strikes, and so on. And because what they were doing, and what they by then were calling the opening, the abertura, was to open up the society to and preparing it for a reemergence of democracy. And we began to use the word redemocratization in Brazil in 1981. And it was finally 1988 when the new constitution was written and passed. But, I'm not quite certain how I got off on that issue. Well, I guess it was that thinking about the possible impacts of the kinds of things that we were doing there. Right. I think the interaction with Pastore in particular, and maybe with Vargas, because Vargas doesn't say very much about what he does with things. But and I get more information directly from Pastore, but at least the interaction with Pastore, perhaps with Vargas, seems to have had a number of effects on policy in Brazil.
And again, this is with what you talked about very early, that you don't do your research to impact on societies in particular.
That's right.
That the research is, that aspect comes out of either the natural results of the research or the people who work on it in mm-hmm. your wake.
That's right, and it's deliberate too, because I'm convinced that whatever research you do, no matter whatever answers and how secure and how important they seem to be, that the utilization of these results is a process that a lot of people have to participate mm-hmm. in, not just a few, and not just a bunch of so-called experts and dictating to other people what they ought to think.
Mm-hmm.
I think our my job, I won't speak for other people, but my job is to say what I'm pretty sure of, that's worth saying, if other people think it's important enough to do something about it, let it enter the public discussion and have its effect. And that seems to have happened. It happened with the status attainment work. It's that work just swept certain sectors of educational policy, and it looks like it happened a fair amount in Brazil too.
Well, working in a country like Brazil, you're sort of taking a chance, is not one. If you start getting into that political, start doing things for political ends or for, I mean, aren't you?
Well,
you
yeah, there's that.
Turn into a Brazilian sociologist.
Well, that wasn't. There is that, and I really went back on, and I always said this in Brazil, that before the military dictatorship existed, and during it and afterward and so forth, that I'm here to learn from Brazilian experience, things that I think are important to learn for more general sociological, theoretical questions. And having learned some of those, if they have practical implications, well, that's fine with me, and I'm happy about it, but it's not what I'm mm-hmm. trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to mm-hmm. try to help Brazil.
Right.
If it helps Brazil, great, but that's not what I'm about. Now, working on stratification research as you can imagine, in a military controlled society could be pretty tricky.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I never really had any great problem with that.
I guess what I'm saying is, wouldn't it be easy to get a great problem with it if you started trying to prove
Well, that would
increase
points. The yeah, that would increase the probability if people thought I was deliberately trying to tamper right. with Brazilian society.
By being more neutral, aren't you? Isn't that actually helpful?
It's a safer position, yeah.
Not only safer, but actually helpful. Because
yeah,
people
probably
are going to know that you're not coming in there with some particular axe that you're grinding. You're not going to come in there finding, mm-hmm. knowing what you're going to find before you actually structure
That's
your research.
A really good point, and you know I hadn't given it the slightest attention. But then I was queried a couple of times. I remember once when we had, in 1968, we had some students from here. Maybe I mentioned this earlier, in the northeast of Brazil, and it turned out that the area that we worked in had been the area where the repression in 1964 had been the most severe, and we just moved innocently into that. Fortunately, we had our own protectors, but at one point, one of the people who was working in the Northeast National Development Center called Sudene, called us together, and he said that he was suspicious of us, and he was the Brazilian State Department of the Northeast himself, and he was tempted to call the president and have us thrown out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do it. And and I really think it was because of personal pique anyway, because João Gonçalves had been, that I mentioned before, João mm-hmm. Gonçalves de Souza, had been the previous head of Sudene, and he had demoted this fellow when he was head. So anyway, and another time I was getting set to go to some from Brazil to some meetings of rural sociologists in the Netherlands, and I got held up at the airport in Rio de Janeiro and finally I was called in and interrogated by a colonel, and I never did find out what it was all about. Mm-hmm. but then they let me get back on the plane, and then they said, because we have so mistreated you, we're going to change your seat from economy class to first class at our expense. So I sat up there, and guess who was sitting beside me? An army lieutenant.
Oh.
and he wanted to talk about what I was doing in Brazil. Mm. Now, whether that was coincidence or whether it wasn't coincidence, who
never
knows?
Never believe in coincidence.
I'm always skeptical of them, but you never know.
Well, now you gave me your theory about, you don't necessarily do this research for Brazil, etc. What about Pastore and some of the students you've just been talking about? Do they operate in a similar vein?
No, not completely. They, to some extent, Pastore is very they're all devoted. I never saw a Brazilian yet who wasn't pretty much devoted mm-hmm. to Brazil. Pastore is pretty convinced that the research that he is doing and that we do together is a contribution to Brazil. And Elcio Saraiva, well, when we've worked on aspects of kind of demography of education, which is still part of stratification work, I guess he's considered because also there's contribution to Brazil. Quirino, yeah, I guess all of them do,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And but we've been able to work together because at least their interests and are not identical to mine, but they do overlap pretty heavily with mine, and I can't see where my working is really on Brazil is manipulative, which I don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we've been able to work it out together pretty well. Anyway, it's pretty clear that Vargas thinks I want. He once arranged for me to give 3 lectures, each one to top officials in each of 3 different ministries. Mm. And he did it on short notice, so I had to plan the lectures after I got there. But we had topics that were appropriate for
each one. How were the lectures received by the ministry?
Well, the 2 of them went over pretty well. Well, mostly. The one, I gave one on the development issue, the regional development issue. And some people were a little upset by that because it ran contrary to the official ones. And the official ones have been drilled into people since they were little kids in school. And to the idea that you could break up Brazil in ways that are not officially sanctioned was kind of upsetting to some of them, even very bright people. But so there was a little bit there. And the other thing that, though, that in a different ministry than I guess was probably labor, that upset people much more was something Pastore and I had done together. What we had done, we measured the changes in the incidence of extreme poverty between 1970 and 1980. And we found, contrary to everybody's belief, that the incidence of extreme poverty absolutely plummeted during that period.
Really?
It was a period of from 1973 to 1982, about, which is most of this 1970 to 80 period. The economy in Brazil really boomed, and jobs were being created at a furious rate per year. Individually, people weren't making very much more, but collectively, families were making a lot more. If more people were in the family had jobs, and therefore there was more income coming into for everybody. So that one, since the common belief was that things get worse and worse all the time, and here was evidence that it was exactly the reverse over that period, that caused a stir. It caused a stir. Well, I gave the same lecture here in Madison too. It caused a stir here. And one of the people who heard it, I think, successfully shot it down for absolutely the wrong reasons, because he made the claim that we were using aggregated data averages when in fact we had individual data on everybody, and that was and that was exactly what we had. But our findings were right, but the belief that under capitalist society things are bound to get worse and worse for the population, it was so well entrenched there for a while that that it, data that was contrary to that were just not credible to anybody.
What did people like the as you characterize the Marxist sociologists think of your and Pastore's theory, or
they don't like it. Yeah. They just ignore it pretty much. I read an article here that came out just in the last month on sociology in Brazil. And it was incredible. It had nothing to do with any empirical analyses of Brazil at all. It had, as a matter of fact, it was almost exclusively devoted to the work of about 3 different people who were associated both with France and with the Department of Sociology at the University of São Paulo.
Interesting.
Nothing about any empirical research at all, anybody's. And so, I don't know, those people, they're, I wouldn't even say they're in left field. They're off in some imaginary stratosphere somewhere. My latest student, who just went down there, he won't touch the the Department of Sociology, which is one of the better ones in the country, he won't touch it at all. And his university is the University of Pernambuco. He's a very bright guy. He's done the best work that's ever been done on earnings of agricultural workers in Brazil. And I'm sure the sociologist won't even know it existed. He's thinking that he may, as of September, go into a Department of Economics.
Sanctuary.
Well, the economists don't have any problem with numbers. and the sociologists can't stand them.
For the last couple of weeks, we've been talking, we've been talking about lots of things, but it's more or less centered around the research that you've been conducting, especially related to Brazil. Can we figure out some way that we can kind of pull what we've been talking about together?
Easily. Let me say, the two main problems I really set out working on were, I wanted to find out how to, and I'm not the only one, other people did too, obviously, including Mr. Sewell, find out how it is, why it is that some people wind up in higher positions and some people in lower positions in later life. And on that one, I in particular worked pretty hard on combinations of social psychological aspects and social structural aspects. And as of 1982, I finally wrote the last piece that I'll probably write on that. Because it requires any new, really new information requires maybe 25 years concentrated research, and by 1982 I felt that I didn't have, I couldn't predict that I'd have my 25 more years to work on it. The second one was to understand how stratification structures vary and to begin to understand what the causes of such variations are. And my first trip to Brazil was aimed at trying to observe both with data and with my own eyes as much as I could about Brazilian stratification and how it was changing, and see if just by thinking about it and dreaming about it, that maybe I could arrive at the main variables by which to describe variations in the structure of stratification. I published a preliminary piece on that in 1965, as I remember, or maybe 66, in a journal that no longer exists, published by UNESCO, called America Latina. But it was 1970 before I really got my mind around it, at least in abstractly. But there were parts of it. It turned out that it's so difficult to get data to test such hypotheses, because you need them on whole societies, and they can't just be little society, little countries with a lot of connections with others. They need to be big societies who are pretty much isolated, relatively speaking, from others. And Brazil has all that characteristic, isolated in the sense of forests and too much water and so forth on the land side, and the Atlantic Ocean on the other side, But you need data on the whole nation, and you need data on variations in the whole nation. I actually worked out some of the analyses early, but it was finally 1992 in the Encyclopedia of Sociology where I first published most of it. And that pretty well states what I think about that second major problem, which was a response to one of the flaws. Well, it was a response to both flaws, as a matter of fact, because the responses are in that Encyclopedia of Sociology article. Since then, I obviously got working on the measurement of development because I wanted to test hypotheses about stratification. Right. And I learned something about how to measure development, and that worked out for Brazil pretty well. I'd like to see it repeated now, because I know those boundaries among macro regions now are going to be somewhat different than they were 27 years ago, but when those original data were collected. And also, they may be fuzzier than they were then, too, but they're pretty well marked at that time. So that ought to be redone, and I doubt that I'm going to be able to do it, but who knows, it could happen. And now the final thing that we've been working on is the measurement of differences among nations in levels of development, and we think we have isolated two major variables that you can say are different, quite different facets of national development levels, and one of those is we call domestic development, comparison among nations in the degree to which their populations are high or low in development levels. And the other one is what we're calling authority, which is the second dimension. It's authority among nations, which is led by total population, but clearly involves the size of the economy, and it involves these things that the Wallersteinians have called cores and peripheries and so forth. And now what I'm trying to do is to tie together, to show logically how to tie together the variations that are possible with stratification structures with the variations in national development in these two dimensions, and then to generate, where possible, hypotheses about how they should be related to each other. That ties it up.
This will carry you into the future, too, work on these variables. Yeah. A question I sometimes ask, you've been engaged in so many different times of fascinating research. What research do you think you have done, performed, or you have achieved that is most important in the field of sociology?
Well,
clumsily ask, but I think you know what I mean.
No, I think contributing to understanding of processes of stratification is, and I think everything that I've done has been an attempt to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And each particular facet, working on aspects of the social psychology of status allocation, or structural aspects, or how structures vary, and beginning to work on what the causes of variations in stratification structures are. I think all of these, in my judgment, they're all very important issues. Let me cut back just one little bit. I do think that for our period in history, and maybe all periods in history, stratification and its variations are one of the most important aspects of human life. They have to do with the way people rank with respect to each other, the way people treat each other, who they respect, who they disrespect, who gets what when, and who can manipulate whom. And I think the stratification area as a whole really illuminates that. And in these days, most stratification research has gone off on racial variations and gender variations, and to some extent ethnic variations. And I think all this is quite important, but it's important practically, it's great importance. Theoretically, it doesn't add very much, I don't think. But the kinds of things that we're doing are absolutely essential for a real understanding of what happens to gender variations, what happens to racial variations, even though we don't work on it. Other people do. I'd call that applied stratification rather than stratification as such.
And it's in terms of the tradition you came out of, this is the tradition that Bill Sewell worked in, and would you consider him your primary mentor?
Oh, yeah.
Just sort of summarize the difference. We've talked about it in detail with Dudley Duncan and Bill Sewell and Kolb and everything, but who do you see as being the people who really gave you the information you needed to take off on your own?
Well, Bill Sewell is probably the most central of all. But I have to go back to Hamlin, too, for some of it.
Okay.
Both of my anthropology professor, Leland Cooper, and also for my history professor, Art Williamson, who had been Rostoff's student here in Madison. And Well, those three, Cole was more important because he kind of set goals. But as far as adding and he did research in Brazil, and he really established the Brazil program that is still going in the Department of Rural Sociology, which has really been had an enormous impact in Brazil. So he has some, he's important, but I don't know how to single them out, but you learn a lot from bright students.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sense that sometimes they know things concretely that you don't know and you need to know, and sometimes they ask the right questions, mm-hmm. and then you go back and think, gee, I should have thought of that, and or taken it into account. So I wouldn't want to single anybody in particular out, because I've learned from each one of them. I have mentioned my American students, but I should mention Joe Wolfel, who's now the chairman of the Department of Communication at University of Buffalo, who's, I guess he's a genius. And Alex Portis, I don't know whether to consider him Latino or American, he's an American citizen born in Cuba. Ed Fink, when I came over here to Madison, first time I came with some projects in my pocket, and I needed personnel, and Joe Wolfel came over, who just finished his prelims, came over to work with me. Together we decided to go look for a research assistant, and so we went through the records. We found Ed Fink's records from Columbia with all his mathematics, and I thought, oh boy, this is our man. Mm-hmm. And so Ed came to work with us. He's a very bright guy. It was just announced in the sociology kind of professional publication called Footnotes that he's has been selected as a visiting professor at Hebrew University and Jerusalem. He's professor of communication and sociology at University of Maryland, and was associate dean of the graduate school for a while. Dave Hansen, who is at Ohio State. You learn from all of these people. Now, I could list others too. Yeah. I'm just mentioning some of them. And I think I've had, 37, 38 PhDs, and you learn from all of them.
Well, again, that's going back to Dr. Pastore's email that he sent me, and he said to how much he respected and listened to students, and how much students have meant to you in your career.
He's right.
Yeah. I'm sure he is. That's certainly come across in this interview.
No, these are very bright people. This is one of the beauties of having been around Madison, at least during this period, and then in the sociology program. We have had awfully good graduate students here, and you can't sensibly treat them as ignorant kids. These are very smart people, and so since nobody has any monopoly on knowledge, and you have smart people around you, you should listen to them.
Sounds reasonable to me. It's amazing how many people don't follow that rather simple advice.
Could be, I don't know.
Yeah, it's been known to happen. I'm going to turn this tape over. I think we're on the... Okay.
I guess in a few words, I feel that my main contribution, or the one I've tried to make, is to a serious understanding of stratification and phenomena. And I guess another one that is really the attempt to assist in the training of very bright people to think important things that haven't been thought well before, and to know when to believe them and when not to believe them.
And I think we're going to leave it at that today. We have one more section. We talked off mic and decided we'll just do that as a unit next week rather than breaking it up. So that's the end of today's interview, the 26th of June.